Joe Donnelly kicks off his campaign to unwelcome musical accompaniment. A legislative study committee begins a gun debate. That plus Pence says more monuments and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 25th, 2017.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Senator Joe Donnelly officially kicked off his reelection campaign, even as Republicans trolled him with a mariachi band.
Donnelly began his campaign with a six-day RV tour of the state focused on veterans issues, the opioid epidemic, and outsourcing. It's that last one that's drawn flack from the other side. Donnelly's long made addressing outsourced jobs a tentpole of his legislative service, but it was revealed last month that Donnelly's family company outsources jobs to Mexico. National Republicans sent a mariachi band to a Donnelly campaign stop this week as they continue to seek to label him Mexico Joe.
Well, sending a mariachi band, is this harmless political fun or a touch of racism? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Daniel Altman, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwannis, the host of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Jennifer Hollowell, the GOP is clearly trying to build a narrative here in response to that July news, but is the mariachi band just a little step too far?
No, I don't think so at all. I mean, seriously, it's fun. Everyone I know who saw this smiled, laughed, thought it was cute. I mean, it's a creative way to highlight something that is a very significant issue in this campaign, and it will continue to be at the forefront. I mean, Senator Donnelly has built his foundation, his image, railing against outsourcing, and then we find out, you know, that for months or years, he has been invested in, he's a key part in his family business that has been outsourcing jobs to Mexico. And it completely undercuts his image, his message, and I mean, it's a serious, serious issue. And hypocrisy, by the way, is one of the most damaging territories for a campaign, and I think that is going to be a big theme this year.
Whether or not it went too far or not, it's certainly effective because we're talking about it here on the show. It got a lot of attention even from the national news, the mariachi band, and calling to mind what had been out there about Joe Donnelly for about a month now. But how do you think the mariachi band will end up backfiring, or was this effective political gamesmanship?
Well, I think it's important to start with the facts. And the first fact is that this is not the senator's family business. It's his brother's business. It's completely different. The second he learned about this issue, he divested himself entirely. I think the stunt was...
When the story came out, he sold his stock. Not when he learned about it. He knew about it for a long time. It was on the website. He knew about it.
I think the stunt...
After it was exposed.
...was trolling at best, and I think if it's not up to whether what we want to call it one way or another doesn't matter as much because plenty of commentators throughout the country have already said just how terrible it was. But I think what it really highlights is the fact that Rakita and Messer simply don't have a record that they can support on this, so they're trying to find any way to distract. Joe Donnelly's been standing up for Indiana workers his entire career. He's done it in the House. He's done it in the Senate. It's what he's going to continue to do. He has a great record on trade. And he's going to continue to do this throughout the entire campaign.
He has disclosed that he's made more than $50,000 a year, or has more than $50,000 a year in stock. He's benefited financially from that business. And, I mean, yeah, your brother's not family.
Now,
who is?
But has now divested from it. And he said he hasn't actually been a part of the company for several decades. But that might not matter to the average voter. Do you think the mariachi band is an effective tool here?
No, I don't, because outside of the explanation that Jennifer's making, I don't think that resonates with... Now, the issue may resonate, but I don't think they put a mariachi band and that investment together. I think that that if they think that's the case, I think they're wrong. It's a stunt. It's in a long history of stunts. It may evoke Mexico, and it may evoke NAFTA or something like that, but I don't think, without further explanation, it gets the point across that they want. And it also is so early in the campaign. It's very interesting that you have these national figures, national players, doing these kinds of things because, you know, they've got, one, the money to spend, and two, this is the hold that they want to make early on. It's a stunt, and I guess that's what it is. That's it.
Do you think it can be effective for the average Hoosier voter?
I don't know if it has legs that would last all the way to the general election, which is what would be required. I mean, yes, outsourcing is a potent issue, but it cuts both ways. I mean, you talk about Jennifer hypocrisy and so forth. Let's keep in mind that the person who occupies the Oval Office right now, his clothing line, most of it was produced by, let's see, in India. I think the suits, the ties came from China. The shirts came from Bangladesh and Mexico. And so if Democratic opponents of the president wanted to take the same tack, you'd have more different international bands than they have at Epcot, probably, all playing together.
But he didn't act like he didn't do that. I mean, the difference, this is where the hypocrisy is different, because the president said, I do this because our regulations are bad and we need to make these changes. So he owned it.
I think it would be hard not to suggest that Donald Trump has been a champion of American, by America, and American jobs for in America within our borders. I don't know. Yeah, I guess that was his response when it came to light that these materials were produced elsewhere. But again, I think for every comment he has suggested or made in years over that there is some value to outsourcing, I could probably find 1,000. Where he's condemning that very process.
Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, is it racist to troll Joe Donnelly with a mariachi band over his family company's outsourcing to Mexico? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, will an Indiana hate crimes bill find success in 2018 now that Speaker Brian Bosma backs it? This was interesting. 48% say yes, it will have success in 2018. 52% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, a special legislative study committee began discussions this week on whether to eliminate Indiana's license requirement to carry a handgun.
12 states currently have laws allowing people to carry guns in public without a permit. Republican Representative Jim Lucas proposed a bill to eliminate Indiana's restrictions last session. He says the right to carry is clear in the U.S. and Indiana constitutions. Numerous law enforcement professionals testified in committee against repealing Indiana's law that requires people to undergo a background check. The state police say it's a safety concern, citing a need for any sort of vetting possible. The committee is charged with considering the issue as it relates to revenue, suicide, and crime.
Daniel Allman, Lucas's bill didn't get a hearing last year, though the issue was certainly talked about in committee. But does this study committee indicate a likelihood of passage next session?
I doubt it, simply because I doubt that Eric Holcomb wants to deal with this right now. In this last legislative term, he did a pretty good job of tuning out the more conservative wings of his caucus, because I think that they've kind of made the calculation that no one went to the polls last year and voted for Eric Holcomb because they want more guns on the street. I think he'd be smart to take a pass on it this time along as well.
You have an interesting sort of back and forth here where law enforcement groups that Republicans have obviously in many ways embraced, as most politicians try to, saying, please don't do this, we don't want this. But a very vocal wing of the Republican caucus, certainly in the House especially, have been calling for this for a little while now. Is this study committee a step towards passage, or is it one of those where we'll throw a bone to the people who want it, but not really go much further?
Well, just because it's in the study committee certainly doesn't mean that it would fly through the legislature. Our caucus is very split on the issue, at least at this point, and that's part of why I think they wanted to have a deep dive into some of the details and ramifications of moving this direction. But, you know, we've got some folks who are very strong Second Amendment supporters, pro-gun right folks, who are not unhappy with the way the current law is.
Right.
And so I think it's a thoughtful discussion that they're going through, and it's a long way from seeing what will happen in the session.
Does this make it the likelihood a little more likely, if you will?
To a degree, but I would caution against reading too much into the appointment of a summer study committee. in terms of seeing that as any kind of signal of likely passage? Because if that were the case, let me just point out, we'd be sitting in a hub of very nice mass transit because you know, throughout central India, and we have nonpartisan legislative districts. We'd have a lot of things that... So basically, I'm being flippant, but the point is, just because there's a summer study committee doesn't mean that the General Assembly is inclined to pass the recommendations.
If it doesn't get through, might it be the revenue issue? That one of the things they're going to talk about in this summer study committee is its impact, the impact of eliminating this license requirement on revenue. And is the revenue going to be one of the things that hold it up, if only because there are people who paid for lifetime licenses that you would now theoretically have to refund or face significant outcry? Could that actually be the stumbling block that prevents this from going through?
Imagine the calculation. Let's see. You're 52, and you bought a lifetime license, and that could be pretty interesting actuarial gymnastics. I don't think that's really part of the calculation. It would be complicating, but I think the ace in the hole, if you will, the cover for people who don't want to change the law, is provided by the law itself. I think the opposition by police officers and others in public safety probably means that this won't go anywhere.
Well, Vice President Mike Pence this week weighed in on the latest controversy over the removal of Confederate monuments from around the country.
Pence said the destruction of private property is unacceptable in the wake of protesters tearing down or damaging Confederate monuments and statues in several cities, including Indianapolis. Recent violence by white supremacist groups has prompted broader calls to remove statues commemorating Confederate figures from the Civil War. But Pence says he thinks it's important for the country to remember its past and not erase it.
Rather than tearing down monuments that have graced our cities all across this country for years, we ought to have been building more monuments. We ought to be celebrating the men and women who've helped our nation move toward a more perfect union and tell the whole story of America.
John Schwannis, should we remove Confederate monuments, or is that erasing our past?
It's a tough one, and I struggle with this because I am something of a First Amendment absolutist, and I also am a student of history, and I appreciate both. I often worry that when you forget history, both good and bad, you can be inclined to make mistakes that you've made in the past. And in some ways, the notion of removing the past sort of dredges up images of the Soviet Union back when, you know, the May Day parade, whoever was in charge of the Kremlin one day, somebody falls out of favor and, like, get the statues out of here, whitewash the wall. It's like that person never existed. Having said that,
On the other hand,
you do look at, I think you, and I'm not somebody who wants to put necessarily motives in the hearts and minds of the artists who created this, but if you look at a lot of the controversial statues that are in the South, particularly, they were put up in the 20th century as basically an in-your-face sort of gesture during the Jim Crow era. That is more problematic to me, I mean, having those there, yeah, than, say, a burial memorial. I mean, Arlington National Cemetery, hallowed grounds, has a Confederate memorial. Now it's basically saying here are the remains of
right.
people who died. And that's similar to what is in Indianapolis down in Garfield Park.
That's right. So here should there be a difference drawn between remembering history, which some monuments can, and actually celebrating some of these figures, which some of the monuments seem to do?
I think that's absolutely the difference that needs to be drawn here. I think John's point about the timing of many of these most controversial monuments is important here. They were put on courthouse steps basically as a warning or as a reminder that we were against you and we still have control. And so I think that's the difference. I think a monument honoring people who died, who are engaged in this war, is indeed a teaching, a memorial, a way to continue to understand the history and continue to know the story in a factual way, rather than celebrating the people who committed treason in order to carry out the war that they did. And so I think that's the distinction, that's the difference.
Vice President Pence, we played some of his remarks, but one thing that he said throughout his answer to the question, and there were a couple of questions about this, one thing he said throughout was this is really a state and a local decision. Is that perhaps the best point, that these decisions need to be made by local governments across the country?
Well, I don't know that they're having that ability in some places. I know down in, I believe it was Alabama this week, you had one, I think it was Birmingham, the mayor attempted to cover up one of the statues, and the attorney general sued them over that, because there's a state law that says that the locals basically don't have that kind of control. I think the thing that confused me a little bit, or I thought was strange about the vice president's statement, was saying that we needed more of these monuments when it's we're talking about Confederate monuments, and I don't understand exactly what it is that he's saying or how he thinks that that could be something that's more appropriate right now. I mean, it just doesn't add up. I mean, I know people have joked for a while that Mike Pence is a man who's kind of rooted in the 50s, and this almost makes it feel like it's the 1850s instead of the 1950s.
I want to ask, the one thing he said did resonate with a lot of people, which that a lot of these monuments have graced our cities for a long time. And when we're differentiating between simply memorials to people who've died versus ones that seem to celebrate some of these figures, is that perhaps the wrong language to use?
No, and I mean, I really take issue with what you just said. Like, that's just a cheap shot. That's not fair. And I don't think specifically he's talking about what kind of monuments. What he's saying is that we have to learn from the past, and, you know, those who don't learn from the past are doomed to repeat it, or whatever that saying is, right? So it's important that we have thoughtful discussions about this, and that we do use history as a way to teach future generations about the mistakes that we've made. I mean, in Poland, they have preserved concentration camps and things so that people can point to it and learn and know a place where we do not want to go again. And I will say, in Indianapolis, we are attempting to have a thoughtful discussion about this, and the council president, Maggie Lewis, and others are trying to do that, and I think that that's the way we should go about it.
The concentration camps are a testament to those who perished there, but they're not filled with glorious statues of Nazis perched on horses with raised arms.
My point is just, we can't erase history, and it's not a good idea to try to erase history. So I think we need to go about it in the most thoughtful way we can.
Well, and there's that's where I think my view disagrees with some of the views about those statues, where you have generals on horses and, you know, the celebrating the people that conducted a war against the United States. That's history, certainly. But it's not a memorial. It's a celebration, and it's they were placed often in the 1890s in an uprising against African Americans, in the establishment of Jim Crow, and in the 1920s of the rise of the Klan. I think that's what's offensive about those memorials, and that's also what differentiates them from the concentration camps, or the one in Garfield Park, or even the one in Crown Hill, where there is a memorial to the remains of Confederate soldiers who died in a prison camp here in Indianapolis. I think that's the big difference.
Well, candidates and potential candidates are starting to line up in the GOP races to fill Luke Messer and Todd Rokita's vacated U.S. House seats.
State Senator Mike Kreider this week formally announced his run for the 6th Congressional District seat held by Luke Messer. He joins Muncie attorney Jonathan Lamb as official GOP candidates in what's considered a safe Republican district. Other state lawmakers are rumored to be interested, as is Vice President Pence's brother, Greg, who's serving on Messer's Senate campaign committee. Todd Rokita's soon-to-be-vacated seat has only one official GOP candidate, former Pence advisor Diego Morales. But Department of Workforce Development Commissioner Steve Braun announced this week he's stepping down from his role amid rumors he'll seek the nomination in the 4th District.
John Ketzenberger, I want to start with Steve Braun. If and when he gets in, as he's largely expected to at this point, he'd likely be the front runner. But he would be a much more moderate Republican than the person he would seek to replace with in Todd Rokita. So is the 4th District, which is one of the most conservative that Indiana has to offer, is the 4th District really ready to move more to the middle?
Well, I guess that's the big question that Braun will have to consider as he goes forward, and I don't know the answer to that. And what complicates that, one of the reasons why I really have a hard time making that calculation, is turnout is so low in primaries, even in highly contested primaries, that often those middle-of-the-road voters, the people who might vote for a Democrat even in a general election, don't come out. And so it makes an already conservative district likely skew even more conservative in that regard. And so I think the challenge for Steve Braun, if he decides to get in, is turnout. And if he's able to turn it out, then he might be able to do it. But, you know, as far as your question, I think the answer is probably not very likely, but it's hard to calculate for those reasons I talked about.
Are we surprised, staying in the 4th District initially, are we surprised at all that there hasn't seemed to be more interest there? Brand Hirschman, State Senator Brand Hirschman, has already said he's not going to run. Frankfort Mayor Chris McBarnes has also said he's not going to run. Are we surprised you're not seeing a little more attention paid to what is a very, very safe Republican seat?
Typically when you see a seat open up in this manner, now, like when who was retired?
John Myers.
I think 14 or 15 Republican candidates stepped forward. There's a lot of pent-up demand usually. Granted, John Myers had been in office longer than either of these than these gentlemen. But it's I am a little bit surprised by that. As far as Braun's candidacy versus others, this is speculation on my part because I haven't seen any polling data from the 4th District, but even as conservative as that is, as you describe it, I'm guessing the number one issue would be jobs, wages, keeping pace with expense, housing expenses, and these types of things. And if that is, in fact, the hallmark of that district, even among conservatives.
Department of Workforce Development.
Somebody who came out of the Department of Workforce Development and has been dedicated to those causes as your champion, you know, might still be a fairly convincing resume.
Moving to the 6th District, that one already starting to heat up. You have a couple of declared candidates, but a lot of people who are exploring, including, like I mentioned, Greg Pence, the brother of Vice President Mike Pence. I want to ask about Greg Pence specifically, because he's one of the biggest names, arguably.
Mm-hmm.
But precisely because of his name, he doesn't have any real political experience other than he's currently working on Luke Messer's campaign. Would that be enough to carry him in a what looks like it could be a very competitive primary?
Well, first let me say State Senator Mike Kreider is very well respected, a very good guy, comes from a good part of that district if you're looking at primary voters.
Yeah.
Hancock County is very important. But, you know, I think that if Greg Pence decides that he wants to get into this race, it really changes the landscape and the dynamics of this race. I mean, he hasn't run for office before, but he has been involved politically and in the community and in business for a long time and has been well known. I mean, he has his own story and brand apart from the vice president, but certainly the fact that he's the vice president's brother will bring a lot of support his way. So I think it'll be interesting and not sure how it might change based on that decision.
Are the voters of the 6th District going to see a Pence name on the ballot and just say check mark?
Well, I think that's probably a little bit premature to speculate on that. I mean, if you go back to
that's what we do here.
I understand that, but if you go back to a year ago today, most we would have done was even money on the Cubs winning the World Series,
right.
Much less the way that the rest of the election results worked out in 2016. So trying to forecast out 12, 14 months what issues are going to matter or what the status of the political landscape is a pretty precarious undertaking. One thing I will say is that these are conservative districts, but you're actually even seeing Democrats that are getting out there and beating the bushes. In the 4th District, there are three different candidates that are out there talking about running. Again, it's a conservative district, but the fact that you're seeing that sort of motivation from the Democratic Party is an interesting sign of the times.
Yeah. Well, an off-script line from President Trump's Arizona rally this week may have thrown a little wrench into Todd Rokita's Senate campaign strategy. Todd Rokita has made defeat the elite the theme of his campaign, seeking to frame himself as the only candidate who will work outside the establishment in Washington, D.C. Yet at a campaign rally in Phoenix this week, President Trump, in one of many extemporaneous moments, railed against the media and bragged about his education and his luxury apartment before saying this.
I think we're the elites. They're not the elites.
Jennifer Hollowell, does Rokita need to rebrand his campaign already?
Well, I think we can say with great certainty that there's no collusion or coordination between the Trump and Rokita camps.
That seems like a good bet at this point. But in all more seriousness, perhaps. I mean, Todd Rokita has made Defeat the Elite really the tentpole, at least so far. Can he sort of shrug off a one-liner from President Trump?
I mean, it's to sort of steal from a song. It's funny how a week can change. Because a week ago, he's defeating the elite, and now he's literally got an 8-page government memorandum that's explaining how you're allowed to give the man coffee. So it's been a rough week, and I guess we'll see what happens moving forward.
John, do you think Rokita shrugs this off and stays the course?
I think President was trying to help him out because he realized that this whole defeat the elite thing is kind of hollow. And I think also that, hitching his wagon to the president, even in Indiana with the big win that the president had, given what the president's been up to, I still think he was trying to do him a favor and say, go ahead and run your own campaign and run on your own merits.
All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Daniel Altman, Republican Jennifer Hollowell, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Ketzenberger of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.